This week on the Finding Impact podcast, we're talking about company culture and how to manage it as you scale with Paul Breloff of Shortlist.
FindingImpact.com. FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.
Hey everyone, my name is Andy Narricot. I'm the founder of Finding Impact, the show where we identify the challenges facing social entrepreneurs and go away and find experts to help solve them. Now, today we're helping founders do that all-important transitioning to scale piece. So, and in particular about culture. I mean, it is the number one thing that founders, experienced founders, want to focus on and think it is incredibly important for their company. In a survey of top executives by Duke University, nearly 80% said culture is among the top five things that make their company valuable, while more than 50% agreed that it influences productivity, creativity, the value of a firm, and growth rates. So if you're a social enterprise leader and you're preparing for scale, this topic will be relevant for you. But before we begin, we're shaping our content for 2020 at the moment, and I want you to have a say. So please drop me an email at andy@findingimpact.com and tell me what you want to hear more about, what challenges you're facing, what challenges you hear are facing social entrepreneurs in the sector, and let us be your virtual advisor on this podcast. So drop me a line, andy@findingimpact.com. I hope you enjoy it. Remember to check out the show notes at findingimpact.com, of course. So the summary and bite-sized takeaways from this episode. And this episode was brought to you by our amazing FEEP ambassador, Tyler Karahalias. If you wish to join her in help to make great content, head over to findingimpact.com and click on FEEP ambassadors. So ladies and gentlemen, I give you Paul Breloff. Hi, everyone. I've got Paul Breloff here, the co-founder and CEO of Shortlist. And we're going to be chatting about the challenges of maintaining culture as your social enterprise scales and tactics for how to adapt and scale your culture with that growth. So Paul's company, Shortlist, helps companies build and develop their teams through a new approach to hiring. Particularly, we'll be talking about Paul's experience as he grew Shortlist team across two continents and to nearly 100 people and lessons he's learned along the way. So welcome onto the show, Paul.
Thanks, Andy. It's great to be here and thanks for having us.
Well, it's a high time I had you on the show. I mean, I've been great admirers of what you're doing, filling a huge need in the capital, human capital area. But before we begin, I have to ask you this swerveball question. Can you provide kindly provide the definition to the word swashbuckle?
I think swashbuckle is more a frame of mind than a definable term. It's something that it came up in the process of defining our values and instantly conjured pirates swinging from ropes with knives between their teeth. And that felt like it captured the kind of adventurous spirit we wanted to embody in Shortlist. So I'm sure it has something to do with kind of like not just what you do, but the manner in which you do it. And that manner being kind of full of pizzazz and energy and adventure. But for us, it invokes this exciting, adventurous state of mind that we try to find at Shortlist.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put everyone out of their misery. So swashbuckle is mentioned in some of the research I've been reading that Paul has written, and I'm going to link up some of those articles on the show notes that Paul has written on Medium, and he talks about swashbuckle. It's hilarious. You should check it out. But let's backtrack a little bit. So Paul, so tell us about why you decided talent was what you wanted to focus on with your co-founders, and why you, give us a little background to yourself.
Great. That'll occupy the next at least 30 minutes of this podcast. So will be the only question you get, Andy. Thanks for that. It's been an exciting few years focused on this issue. My background is mostly in non-talent social enterprise and impact investing. After kind of false starts early in my career in advertising and corporate law, I've really been fascinated with social enterprise and impact businesses and impact investing for about 14, 15 years now. And for most of that time period, been very focused on financial inclusion. Initially set up or was part of a team of people that set up a community development bank in the US that led to microfinance. And then that led to running a financial inclusion impact fund called Axion Venture Lab, where we're investing in fintech startups around the world. And I think the theme underlying all of that has always been looking at for-profit business models that could expand access to opportunity in different ways. And for a long time, I still find a lot of interest and fascination in the way financial services can unlock that opportunity, particularly credit at the right moment, unlocking people's ability to invest in income-generating assets, build their livelihoods, and that's always been interesting to me. I think I kind of pulled up a few years ago, and initially I noticed this human capital issue cropping up with the companies I was investing in.
Okay.
I'd go to their board meetings, and after closing an investment round, money was no longer the problem, and it immediately became finding the right people, and finding the right skilled talent, but also finding the right junior talent, thinking away about the ways that new teams and fast-growing teams were fitting together to accomplish goals, ways that culture was enabling teams to do a lot of things or disabling them. And so seeing this critical talent gap in companies was intriguing, as well as, frankly, the fact that as I looked out and contemplated what I was excited about, access to opportunity issues, and frankly, the things I had most enjoyed in my career, thinking about how I could help young professionals that I could so deeply empathize with find careers that made sense to them, finding careers that had an element of purpose and meaning in them, and thinking about all the ways that the world was changing to make it easier to match people to the right jobs, but also help them figure out what jobs are out there. How do I get those jobs? How do I get upskilled? I think we got interested in this, realizing there's just a whole lot more work to be done in human capital, rather than just kind of financial capital, where I think a lot of focus has been this last 10 years.
Yeah, definitely good. Quick sort of backstory. That's great. So, and I was just chime in there with I see, particularly when you've got very ambitious growth startups that, you know, that they've sort of pitched this incredible, you know, ambition and vision that they want to achieve, and the capital arrives to match that. But then the shortfall is in, you know, well, how do we, you know, implement that? And people is what implements that. It's not just capital. So then that's the next piece. And you can't just sort of acquire that like you can with capital. It's a much bigger lift and much bigger challenge. So kudos to taking this big one on.
That's right. And I think we looked at that. My co-founder, Simon, had been investing in clean energy startups. I had been investing in fintech startups. And realized that, frankly, investors' comfort zone, my comfort zone, was talking about fundraise rounds and strategy, and the messy reality of building teams and getting the right people on those teams are something that don't get talked about as much at board conversations, but frankly, is often the make or break of whether these companies work. And so I think Shortlist emerged directly from those experiences. Would it be helpful to explain a little what Shortlist is?
Yeah, please. And what is your magic sauce?
Yeah, so we started Shortlist to kind of get into the range of these human capital issues. And I think most immediately we were focused on what we saw as a broken, inefficient process of hiring, and focused on finding ways to bring technology to bear to improve the efficiency of hiring. We were just seeing a lot of wasted time posting jobs to job boards, reviewing CVs. No one enjoys looking through 1,000 CVs, but yet everyone was doing it. We saw miserable candidate experiences. Job boards have made it really easy to click apply, but it's a pretty demoralizing experience. Very few people expect to ever back from these jobs they apply from. So this constant black hole dynamic. And then I think what we were probably most interested in is trying to find ways to collect and use data beyond just the CV. We're realizing that in the markets we were working in, particularly India and East Africa, there's a lot of great talent out there that doesn't have great CVs. And then there's a lot of people that are lucky enough maybe to have parents that send them to good schools or good corporate experience, still aren't necessarily the best people you could find for a particular job. So we were interested in trying to create data where there hasn't been any about skills and interests and motivation levels and things like that. And so what we've created as a company is a platform that connects skilled professionals to great careers. We work in India and Kenya. We've built a range of different tech tools that automates the collection of data points beyond just the CV. We do look at experience and education, but as just a set of factors among a broader set of factors. And this includes a chat bot that chats and collects information, kind of like a WhatsApp interface. We have over 1,000 different skills assessments that assess both general cognitive abilities and professional skills, but also gets very detailed as product, tech, design, finance questions, video and audio interviewing. And then we make it easy for employers to interact with that data in a candidate dashboard so people can make better decisions. So we've been hard at work building that, focused on collecting data beyond CV, also trying to start to branch into ways that we can be more than just another job board to young people and young professionals, starting to layer in more career discovery options, career advice and content, linkages to training providers and upskilling courses. So if you don't get that job, you know where to turn to find and get yourself ready for those opportunities. So we launched about 3.5 years ago. We are in India and Kenya. Worked with about 600 companies to date, have close to 1 million people kind of on our platform, in our database, and starting to get really excited about ways to ramp that up and start making it a lot more efficient for companies to find the people they need, but also for young people to figure out what careers are best for them and figure out how to get started on those careers.
Amazing. Well, we're just now going to move on to the culture piece because that's a really rapid growth period, I think. 3.5 years to 100 employees and 1 million people on your database. So I'd love you to come, first of all, to work out how you define shortlist culture in the first place. I mean, we'd love, this is going to be relevant for the early startup, founder teams who established their company and then they want to say, right, and they've probably read somewhere the Drucker quote, culture eats strategy for breakfast. I think that's what he said.
Exactly.
So and they know it's important, right? So how did you do that? And, what did you... Yeah. Well, let's start with that. How did you do that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that, and I saw this over and over again when I was an investor looking at companies. I do think most entrepreneurs probably start with what is the idea, what is the strategy, what is the product, and I think left to our own devices, my co-founder Simon and I probably would have done the same. We benefited from having an amazing third co-founder, Matt, one of my college roommates, who had kind of been a serial entrepreneur and had built and bootstrapped a business almost straight out of college for 10 to 15 years. And I think learned, I was ultimately a very successful business, but learned through that process that really the way to build a competitive edge and to survive and thrive over time was to invest in culture, in values, in getting the right team in place. And so he in particular really pushed us to spend a lot more time than I think most companies do at start, defining our purpose and our mission, investing in uncovering for each of us why we were doing this, why were we making these crazy leaps onto an entrepreneurial journey. And then of course, investing in a process as a team, once we had a team, about what was important to us and what those values were. There were a lot of different steps to the process. I think one of them, of course, is the act of defining your values. And I think this was something we were quite intentional about and kind of approached it initially as a big, messy brainstorm among the team, particularly the leadership team of, I think it was about 8 to 10 people at that time, which was probably about half the team at that time. Really just going into
what mattered to us? What was important? What were, when did we feel like we were at our best in our team? What were the things that we liked talking about? What values or words resonated? Kind of generated a big mess of ideas and phrases. Ultimately, we felt that culture initially needs to come from co-founders. We took the responsibility to take that word cloud away and went somewhere we thought was suitably adventurous to the coasts of Kerala in India, and kind of spent quite a bit of time playing around to ultimately arrive at value statements, four initial value statements that we really believed in that could embody our what we thought were important. And I think what was great about that is we did focus on coming up with values that could be, I don't know if that's the right word, but disagreeable. Like we wanted to find values that weren't just boring, everyone would agree with, but rather ones where we could find examples in other companies where that wasn't the case. Like one of our values is act with intention. And this is about doing the work to get clear. This is about being intentional and stepping with purpose and thinking about progress in small steps. And you know, we know very well cultures like move fast and break things. And I think that we're like, no, we're not that one of those companies. Maybe it's because we're slightly older as entrepreneurs, but whatever it is, like, no, we want to be really intentional. We'd rather spend a little bit of time to get clear on why we're doing something, what we're trying to learn, rather than just rushing and doing that. Be a whole person is another really important important one for us. We're more than our work. It's about integrating work and personal life, learning from differences. If you think about the way Tesla or SpaceX runs, where it is all about work and it's understood that's what's important. I think we have a slightly different tack. So we kind of went through that process. I think that was great. But then, you know, as we might talk more about, I think getting those values down that you can hang on the wall is really just step one to trying to define a great culture.
Yeah. But from what I take from that is it starts from within. You don't look to say, what should we be? It's starting at the co-founders, quite right, because, you know, it's your company. But you're saying, so you're asking yourselves particularly, what is your why? And then getting this brainstorm together to see what surfaces, what matters to people, what's important. And then I like this bit of what sets you apart. It's like, what don't set, put on your values list what, it, you know, just like show up for work, because of course you're going to show up for work. It's what sets you apart. What do you want to make yourselves unique, that if someone was looking at two companies and they were like, well, which one do I want to join? They might go to the one that actually, you know, that speaks to them more clearly of what it means to be part of that company, right?
That's right.
And how important was it to be an offsite, to be a, completely away and sort of immersed in your in a, an environment maybe that's natural to you, like off the coast of Kerala?
I don't think it's critical, but I do think that one of the things we realize is really important is trying to find the right perspective from which to tackle problems. And oftentimes getting out of your comfort zone lets you kind of create a temporary alternative world that shakes your normal approach to things, lets you see things more clearly, lets you see the forest for the trees. So I think for us, it was useful. Separate from our culture or our values, it's something that as co-founders, when we started the company, we made a really clear intention that at least once a year, I think, and we wrote it down somewhere. I don't know where exactly this still lives on, but we wrote down that once a year, we as co-founders would retreat to somewhere suitably adventurous. And one of our values is find the adventure. And the last imperative of find the adventure is the word swashbuckle, which you mentioned at the beginning. Yeah. So we decided that we wanted to be getting out to places that meant something to our markets ideally, but also were adventurous. So we have been to the base of Mount Kenya. We've been to the coast of Kerala. We've been to Mexico, which really had nothing to do with it, except we just found a cheap way to do it. And I think we've made good on this this commitment to each other and to the company that we would pull ourselves out of the day-to-day for at least 3-4 days together, invest in the relationships with each other and take some time to get perspective on the company, set some goals. And I think that has been a really useful exercise. It's something I would hope for all founders and entrepreneurs to create space to think outside of the everyday.
Brilliant. We're just going to crowdsource some future ideas for your getting out of your comfort zone. If anyone has any ideas of how the co-founder of Shortlist should get out of their comfort zone and go to some of these things that you might just...
The requirement is that it has to be incredibly cheap or free. We usually fund these ourselves. So while it seems exotic, and we welcome all ideas. If anyone has any spare houses on the beach or in the mountains, yes, we would
love jail
that.
Cell somewhere, you know.
Or anything that breaks the norm.
So have these changed as you've grown? That's the big question. So those were the big ones at the beginning. And what's changed as you've grown to 100 people? And do you expect them to change some more?
So I think that value should be able to generally stand the test of time. I do think we have had one change where we actually added in a fifth value, inspired by a company, training company that we merged with, and found that as we reflected on our own values, there was a lot of almost individualistic values, which didn't really reflect the sense of team that was so foundational to how we approach our work. So we did add a value, one team that entered. I think as we've grown, less significant than the words of the values is how we make those real, but also how we make the general fabric of our teamwork and the overarching kind of like cultural milieu that we exist in, how we make that work. And I think finding ways to make sure that we make these values real in terms of how we give feedback, how we give each other high fives in team meetings. I'd love to do this again, but my co-founder Matt was running for a while an internal podcast where he would interview team members about a little bit about their story, but then talk about and go deep on one particular value that would give us a way to kind of lend some texture to what people were thinking about and what these meant to particular people. But even more than that is trying to create the kind of broad scale culture of safety and vulnerability and familiarity that's really hard as we grow. We're now 80 people. We're now in 3 offices that need airplane rides to connect. We have about 30 people, probably about 35 people in Nairobi, 30 or so people in Mumbai, 15 or so people in Hyderabad. And so finding ways to create that sense of both shared culture, but also tolerating office level differences, I think has been more the challenge and what we've had to try to figure out over the last year or two.
Brilliant. So let's focus on that. And I'm sure many people are thinking about that. They're opening up another office, which is a plane ride away. It's quite far away. How do you sort of initiate that office and try and instill the culture apart from just having it written down? You know, how do you start well on the front foot? And then how do you maintain that? And speak to some of the, you know, some of the things you've tried. As you said, that's a key challenge. What are some of the things you tried, and you know what has been successful, not so successful?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that we were fortunate in some ways that we started all 3 offices around the same time, so we didn't have to kind of layer in additional offices. But in the early days, when we were still a small number, we invested in a lot of painful calls and meetings that probably in some ways was driving everyone crazy because the telecommunications wouldn't stand up and the videos would drop and everything. But we really found it important. I can't remember if it was every week or every other week to get all the offices hooked up, talking to each other, giving high fives to each other across the offices, talking about what's going on in the company. And so doing that early, making sure that we as co-founders, who were frankly doing probably most of the inter-office travel in the early day, we're trying to bring a consistency and values and culture to the team, I think was really important. And making sure that there was kind of enough opportunities for exchange, creating projects for people to work on, so they get to know each other. So we did a lot of that in the early days. I think as we've gotten bigger, the shift in focus is more to what can we experiment with to make this distributed structure work? And I do think that the future is probably distributed teams. I think in the future, some of the best jobs and the highest ways to create value will be in roles that are increasingly digitally oriented, and they can be done from anywhere that you have a computer and a Wi-Fi connection. And I think we will continue to see very rapid advances. I don't know how rapid they'll be, but I'm sure it'll be kind of like we blink at some point in the next 5 to 10 years, and then all of a sudden, it'll be a lot easier to work across great distances with people. And I don't know if that will come from, you know, next level Slack and Zoom innovations. I don't know if it's like augmented reality and virtual reality, but I do believe that in the future, it's going to be far more common for people in the digital economy to be working day to day, side by side with people that are sitting anywhere in the world. So we do think that that trend's really important. We're happy to lean into it. We do also acknowledge, though, it's the early days and that there's a lot of pain and suffering that we have to try to endure in the early days and missed opportunities of not being able to do things face to face. Certainly for us, some of the things that have worked are creating global informal places to spark more chatter and more sharing of personality. Our global WhatsApp group is quite active, quite silly, not very professional. Doesn't really get used for any kind of business, but just generally lets people throw emojis back and forth.
Well, that's what it's for.
Welcomes exactly.
That's good. That's great.
And we resist that. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff we can get into.
Let's get into that. I want to know some sort of practical, you know, things that you've tried. You know, WhatsApp group is great. It's a great thing. And I think many others can do that and, you know, almost say no work in this group. You know, it's this telling jokes, it's how was your weekend? You know, it's that informal stuff, which is so important. Yeah. For groups to work well together.
Yeah, so I think WhatsApp has been significant. I'm not a big Slack user, but I know that certain subgroups of the team have used Slack quite a bit. I think creating opportunities for face-to-face and real-time connection is critically important. So for us, that means making sure that we travel a lot, but also investing in the team to fly between India and Kenya. Probably in ways that sometimes make our head of finance a little bit nervous, but oftentimes the benefit of those trips is not simply in whatever project got worked on, but it's the way that there's a cultural transmission. There's kind of a team intimacy. There's ways that the person showing up from, say, India to Kenya brings a little bit of flavor from what's going on in India and then can take those ideas from Kenya and bring it back to India and vice versa. So the travel is really important. We do at a leadership team try to, even though it's expensive, make sure that we're getting, say, the top, the kind of 8 to 10 leaders in the company to a single location probably twice a year. It's expensive. It's a break from the everyday, but we found it's incredibly important that starting at the top, that we're aligned, that we know each other as people, that we have fun together, that we're able to have tough conversations in the same room. And of course, investing in technology that lets you do this. And I'll admit, this is still something we have not figured out. We still struggle with reliable internet in both offices. And it's something that it's not a money thing. We just have to kind of figure that out. But I would urge companies, myself included, do not try to save money when it comes to making sure you've got high-speed internet, that you've got video conferencing technology, that you've got the right kind of speakerphone technology. It really is amazing the tax imposed by conversations that are on a 2 to 3 second delay. or trying to have conversations where you can't really hear the person, or as in most cases, where you can't see a facial expression, or can't kind of respond or cut or sort of cut into a conversation in an efficient, dynamic way. So a lot of things around how we invest in and make real the communication and kind of relationship building across offices.
Brilliant. Anything else? I mean, you've got that sort of virtual groups, virtual connections. Anything to do with sort of interpersonal relationships? You try and get people talking together more frequently between teams and stuff like that?
Yeah, or? For sure. For sure. So we do have more formal structures like town halls every couple of months that a bit chaotic, but get the whole office together.
What are they?
A lot of, that's our one time where we try to get everyone on a single Zoom call with video across all the offices.
Wow.
That's where we'll welcome new folks, say our goodbyes to people who might be transitioning out or moving on to something else, celebrate promotions, give each other kind of high fives, specifically cross office high fives. So high fives essentially being, a thanks and shows of gratitude for something someone did. Could be as small as sending an email that was useful or much bigger. And then going into kind of a few topics of global significance or interest and creating space for whatever tough questions people want to throw at really anyone on the leadership team. So we do town halls. I do think that a lot of the relationship building happens at a local level, and through different it's kind of mini innovations that the team creates. So the tech team had quite a lot of engagement with a Biggest Loser fitness challenge, where they all decided, hey, we want to get healthier, and they like set a goal of I guess weight loss and fitness and really kind of did a lot of things together around that. In Kenya, they have something called Wellness Wednesdays that have become very popular, where for about 15 minutes, I think it's at 2 p.m. I always get my time zones confused. It's like 2 p.m. It might be 4 p.m. Sorry, Kenya team. On Wednesdays, everyone breaks for about 15 minutes and does a mini yoga in your chair session.
Awesome.
Or a mini meditation or something like that. Bombay's got Friday night music and drinks. And so I think we do want to invest in those relationships. A lot of them happen locally, but we also do want to make sure we're getting people to visit teammates in other countries as well. So excited to have more people start traveling between the offices.
And I've got to ask, I mean, have you ever had any pushback maybe from board members or investors about, you know, it seems like you're having too much fun, you know, where's the work? Do you ever have any comments like that being said?
We don't. So please don't give them any ideas.
Good.
Okay. No, we haven't. I think that, I think in some ways we've got a great set of investors and stakeholders around the table. And we've made it really clear that, look, we don't always get it right. I think we're a student, students much more than we're experts on these topics, and we're trying to figure it out. But we do make it clear that we care passionately about building a great team. In some ways, I think startups forget this a lot, but I think that yes, a startup has a product, but in some ways, one of the startup's most important products is the company and is the team and making sure it works well and it's functioning well. I think our stakeholders invest in us as much because they believe that and they want us to be caring about that and investing in that, as like as kind of the other side of that, which is like, hey guys, save money, get back to work. What's up? Stop with this meditation stuff, etc.
Brilliant. Any resources or books or things that you've turned to that you could recommend to others to maybe sort of swat up if they're thinking about this in more detail?
Yeah, a whole bunch. And in fact, in the next few days, we'll be putting out a blog about some books I've loved. And I think I've got a whole section on sort of books and resources related to culture and team building. You know, I think one that made a big impact on me and I think several leaders on the team was a book called The Culture Code. I think I'd read a lot of books focused on culture as a set of values or culture as purpose. I really loved the book Culture Code because it talked about those, but it started broader and it thought about what are these factors that make some teams more or better than the sum of their parts and some teams less. And when you start asking that, you get a whole set of behaviors and ways of working together and the natures of great teams that focus on safety and vulnerability and purpose that go beyond just values. So I think that book was great. I love stories of companies that have created successful cultures. Danny Meyer's book, Setting the Table, is such an interesting view of enlightened hospitality. The book, I think it's Delivering Happiness on Zappos has been great. Mm. Also recently very interested in a book called Primed to Perform, which talks about not just culture so much as the nature of motivation and the different reasons people are motivated to do their work and how certain motivational reasons, particularly ones around a sense of pure enjoyment and play or purpose or developing yourself for your future career aspirations generate better performance and better work than ones we often think about like making more money or just trying to respond to pressure from teammates or things like that. And so thinking about ways to shape the motivational context, I think has been particularly on my mind of late. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of resources out there and hopefully more. I know I've been excited to see an increasing focus on how to make distributed teams work, an increasing recognition that as we move to a future where hopefully we'll have a more meritocratic talent marketplace globally, where companies are able to hire the best people for jobs where no matter where they sit, and care less about their ability to commute each day to a physical office. I think I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more resources come out on that.
Amazing. Well, we're going to link up a lot of those resources that you've shared, and please share the blog post as it comes out because this will be live after probably. But this has been incredible. I mean, it's amazing to hear your passion come through in wanting to create an amazing company that people can really put themselves into and feel good about who they are. And it's not just showing up and collecting your paycheck, but actually living a meaningful life of purpose, you know, work, personal, it all melds together at the end of the day. So congrats on that. And
thanks so much.
Thanks for coming on and sharing what, you know, this topic, which you've obviously thought a lot about.
Thank you so much, Andy. I really appreciate it and love the work you're doing. Certainly, I think we both were lucky enough to find career trajectories in this world of social enterprise and impact. And so very excited about the work you're doing.
Findingimpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.